Hello, fellow contrarian a-holes. You have found your destination, and that is Objection, the worldwide leader in contrarian a-holery. And I am Judge David Johnson, one of the contrarian a-holes, joined by Judge Dan Mancini, another contrarian a-hole. And I just got through saying that like three times without slipping up, which I was shocked by.
It's a great improvement.
Thanks.
We can tell that you've been practicing.
I have been, yes. I have been doing the warm-ups before and after the gym, you know, just really trying to work that in. So Dan, it's been a while since we've recorded. We've been pretty diligent about getting some stuff recorded ahead of time. So this is one of the first times we're up against the deadline, huh?
I know.
I guess.
I know. It's like record now or no show next week. That's kind of scary.
It is. We're being contrarian against the idea of show preparation in for a second.
We did procrastinate this time.
We did. Well, anyway, here we are, and we are going to tackle a subject that's been kind of near and dear to our hearts, but the theme of this particular episode will be kind of James Bond. So it'll be a James Bond theme for us. And before we kind of unveil the contrary position we're going to take, why don't we kick off with a supporting the consensus position, which namely is Roger Moore Bond movies, save for maybe one, I know maybe two, largely stink and are awful. And he was a pretty rough Bond if you really think about it.
Yeah, I hope that's a standard.
It may not be, actually. I don't know. Maybe that is a contrarian position. I don't know. I mean, everybody hates Octopussy, right? Right?
Yeah, I would hope so, really.
I mean, everybody hates the slide whistle in The Man with the Golden Gun car stunt and the dumb pick in the, you know, riding shotgun. Everybody hates that, right?
And I would hope that everybody hates Moonraker, too, because that's a horrible, horrible movie.
Which one has the pigeon or whatever doing a double take in Venice? Which one is that?
What is that one?
That was awful. Maybe that was Octopussy? Is that possible? I don't know.
It might have been, yeah.
I mean, Octopussy had... I mean, that was really the nadir of Moore's exploits.
He had a string there at the end of his tenure that was really, really bad.
I mean, he looked like...
Raker and then Octopussy and... View to a Kill, he was getting to look like Methuselah.
That's right. And those weren't as cheesy and campy as the other one. Like, I have more of a trouble with the campiness, you know? I mean, it sort of looked like someone pried him out of a Barca lounger with a crowbar for View to a Kill.
But, is View to the Kill the one where he's snowboarding down on, like, a board from a...
Yes.
Snowmobile, yep. And he goes across some water, and they play a Beach Boys tune.
That's pretty awful.
For a second. Yeah, that's
that's awful.
Painfully bad.
There's like a hidden submarine in that. Yeah, that is pretty bad. The one saving, and you had pointed out a piece of trivia that I was unfamiliar with, but I am actually a big fan of For Your Eyes Only, which I think followed Moonraker, and I think John Glenn, who hint, he's going to play a role in. We'll be talking about in the second part of the show. But when he directed For Your Eyes Only, he made a conscious effort. Let's make this grittier, more badass, because Moonraker was just redonkulous. that's generally one of my favorite Bond movies.
Yeah, it is a good one. And that was, the point I made on Facebook was that most of the awesomeness in it, particularly a scene where a bad guy's in a car and Bond kicks the car, like kicks the fender, and the car goes over a cliff, killing the guy.
One of the most full-blooded homicides, really, you know?
And Roger Moore didn't want to do it. John Glenn had to force him to do that scene.
Because it's ironic. I mean, when he does that kind of stuff, it's really cool. He pulls it off.
Yeah.
Like, and again, I'm getting my Moore movies all mixed up, but there's one scene, and I can't remember the movie it is. He's at the top of a building interrogating a guy, and the guy's like hanging onto him by his tie. And when he gets this information, he just swipes the tie out of his hands. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a stone cold killer.
Man, he's great when he does that. It's like he didn't grasp that's what the character is.
I know.
You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, Connery wouldn't have hesitated at all to kick a dude off a cliff.
He would not. I mean, For Your Eyes Only, too. I mean, it was borderline corny. But the opening action sequence with a helicopter. Tossing with his face down the chimney stack was a lot of fun. But, I mean, that was a generally great – I thought that was a generally good, badass Bond movie, and it starred Topol from Flash Gordon, which is excellent.
Always good. We'll be – that'll be coming up later, too, Flash Gordon connections.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. You know, then you get Octopus.
Oh, man, that's bad. The buzzsaw.
Oh, the buzzsaw killer, the fake crocodile boat, just the time he took to get into a clown makeup while a nuke was sticking down.
Well, just the clown makeup.
The clown makeup.
The idea that there is a movie, a James Bond movie, in which he disguises himself as a clown.
That's bad. I believe, speaking of sound effects, and again, we've talked about the slide whistle sound effect and that unbelievable car stunt. Like, if I was that driver doing that car stunt, which is a real practically done car stunt.
Right.
And I saw, like, the dailies, or I saw, like, post-production that they put the stupid slide whistle. I would have attacked someone with a 2x4, but
right. But like, my children were almost orphans.
That's right, for this.
And you threw a slide whistle at it.
But I believe it was Octopussy. Speaking of sound effects, did that not have a Tarzan sound effect? I believe.
Yeah, it did somewhere.
Swinging, and he had a Tarzan sound effect. So, I mean, as far as my most hated campy elements in Roger Moore movies, that's up there. But I think the double take by the pigeon, maybe the worst one. I mean, that's almost as bad.
That's pretty bad.
I don't want to cross the genres here, but that's almost as bad as in Superman 3, where the walk and don't walk figures in the walk signs climb up and start beating on each other. I mean, I think you could make an argument for The Spy Who Loved Me, too, perhaps. You know?
Yeah, that one's not bad.
That's not too bad. That's nice and violent at the end.
I always liked Live and Let Die, too, because it's like a really weird episode of Starsky and Hutch or something.
That's true.
It's in America.
Yeah, that's true.
There's like a lot of American cars, you know, old muscle cars and stuff, which is kind of cool.
That's true.
And it kind of feels like it's supposed to be a Sean Connery movie.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it's Roger Moore's first one.
And it's pre-campiness, too. It's not. It doesn't really... You know, plus Jane Seymour is scorching hot in that movie, too, so that's helpful.
It has the ridiculous elements, like the dude from Homicide or whatever being inside the suit and, like, zipping it down the front as a fake guy and pulling. Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well,
or the fact that he gets blown up at the end.
Yeah, let us not forget that is that has the worst final bad guy death I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
The worst. Awful. I also love how John Carpenter apparently stole the ending from Live to Die for Big Trouble in Little China, I think, right?
And it works so much better, yeah.
It's it. So China. Much better. Whatever that thing was a lot more fearsome than Baron Samedi, so. So anyway, yeah, so, I mean, I'll give Moore his props. I am disappointed to hear that he fought against that badass awesome scene in Free Eyes Only.
Because that is badass.
It legitimately is. And he had a pretty good one-liner quip after that, you know? He didn't have the head for heights. Not bad. It's not bad at all. So, and he was a master of the awful one-liners, you know, or the double entendres, you know. So that business is taken care of. So now we're just going to stay within the Bond universe and take up the banner, the standard of, I believe, an unfairly maligned Bond. Though I do say maybe as the years have gone past, he's gotten more respect. You think that's possibly? You think that's accurate?
I think that's probably accurate.
I mean, so because he was kind of put in that unenviable position where he was, you know, placed after. So he's following up Moore, who was in it forever, but really on the downside of the franchise. And before, like, Pierce Brosnan kind of gave it new life.
See, yeah, I think a lot of times on this show we say how, you know, critics were sort of easy on a movie. And then the internet fanboys kind of peed in everybody's Cheerios.
Yeah,
with their complaining and bitching and moaning. And I think it's the reverse here. I think, you know, critics initially really didn't like this guy. And the fanboy set has kind of redeemed him a little bit.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And we are, of course, talking about Timothy Dalton, who appeared as Bond in two movies, Living Daylights and License to Kill. He had gone out for the Bond role prior, I believe, right?
Yeah.
He was deemed too young.
Yeah, I think when George Lazenby got it. Yeah. Yeah, I think it was all the way back then.
Oh, there you go. But he eventually does come around and snags the roles. Now, do you have any – I mean, this isn't a specific movie we're kind of defending. So, I mean, I think it's just more anecdotal. I mean, have you been able to track down any kind of bad stuff?
I have.
Oh, you did. Very good.
Around, yeah. Yeah, I actually did a little homework.
I like that.
I looked at reviews for both of his movies and found some swipes at him.
Oh.
One of them is the casting of Timothy Dalton as James Bond in this 15th entry. This is for The Living Daylights. Into the adventures of 007 is widely considered a classic mistake.
Oh.
Dalton isn't suave like Sean Connery or even Roger Moore.
Suave. I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's another one. This one's for License to Kill. Though an obvious improvement over The Living Daylights, License to Kill's egregiously gritty sensibilities ultimately ensure that it often feels more like a typical 80s actioner than a bona fide James Bond adventure. With Timothy Dalton's less than charismatic turn as the infamous secret agent exacerbating the film's various problems.
Oof. Is it on the, for License to Kill, the Bond women are pallid mannequins, and so is the misused Dalton, a moving target and a civil role suit for every plausible reason. He looks as bored in his second Bond film as Sean Connery did in his sixth.
Yeah, that was a Richard Corliss one.
Yep, that is. You know, even here is like a positive review, but it kind of it's like a backhand compliment. License to Kill gave us a grittier and more ruthless Bond. Dalton can definitely play dark, but he lacks the charisma of Connery. So it's like, yeah, he can punch people in the face, but he's not likable, you know, translation.
And you know, the lacks the charisma of Connery thing is sort of like the, well, it's not as good as Die Hard criticism of an action movie.
That's right. Like, you're comparing him to the original. You know, right.
All right. Give me a break, man.
Well, that being said, I believe it now falls to us to kind of push forward and defend this man's honor. So it is now our move.
Okay, it's your move.
And once again, thank you, Mr. Harrigan. And to help us out with this noteworthy endeavor is our pal Mike Rubino. Mike, how you doing?
Hello, gentlemen.
Welcome aboard. We welcome
you
back to this this noble pursuit we're about to do. Now, you had said that it's been a while since you've seen The Living Daylights, but you do recall License to Kill with some degree of amicability,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah, I consider License to Kill to be one of the best. Not the best, but one of them. It's up there. And Living Daylights, I sort of judge all of my Bond films from how often I've seen them. That's a good indicator as to how much I like them. So, you know, there are a handful that I've seen once. Even though I have them all, there's some that I've seen once and some that I've watched, you know, return to again. And
yes.
Living Daylights is one of those ones where I think I saw it as a kid and I might have played some sort of really crappy DOS game based on it.
Nice. Yes, they did make a game based.
those DOS games were like my first introduction to James Bond. I was playing them before I'd seen the movies. But yeah, License to Kill, I think, is an excellent Bond film, and I reviewed it quickly this evening before the podcast, and I was reminded as to how, you know, how awesome it is.
Even with a tractor trailer that pops a wheelie, you know, even with a semi.
I mean, okay, no, admittedly, yes. Yeah, the ending is it feels a little over the top compared, especially in comparison to like the rest of the movie, which feels fairly
grounded in
reality and gritty. And that ending is sort of like they were saving up all their money for the big ending or something.
Although, to be fair, it's like they actually went out and built a semi that can do that. So
yeah,
it's not, they didn't even use wire. So it's like it doesn't make any sense in the real world, but they actually built one. So
yeah,
you know, that kind of dulls the weirdness a little bit of that.
Yeah. You know, it was something I was thinking about while you two were talking was that I think Dalton and George Lazenby and Daniel Craig, the three who have done arguably the least amount of Bond films, are the closest to the literary character and the closest to the books. I don't know if you've read any of the books, but
that is a rumor. That's true. That is what I hear.
Oh yeah, it's not a rumor. I mean, I've read some of the books. I can confirm.
All right, very good.
Yes, I mean, I'm a big George Lazenby supporter. I love that film.
I just can't get over the kilt. I think like the kilt.
But yeah, the kilt.
And
okay,
then he's just like. I mean, I actually liked it more than I thought I remembered liking it. I mean, there's like, I know we're digressing a little bit.
Yeah, I don't want
to. Maybe Lazenby is worth a defense.
I'll defend him. Anyway, I'll defend him to the death.
Okay, well,
no, he was a good one.
All right, well, we'll save Lazenby maybe for another show. Continue.
Arguably, you know, Lazenby and Dalton and Daniel Craig, and it's not his fault that Craig's only done two, but, you know, those ones are more reserved, grittier Bonds, and they have, so far, shorter lifespans than the other ones. And maybe that's because they don't appeal necessarily to a mass audience like the suave, charming you know, wink and a nod Bond that, that Sean Connery kind of is, you know, Roger Moore definitely is, and Pierce Brosnan eventually became. You know, like, those, the ones that have had the longer runs have been outright goofy, but they were definitely having fun, they were smiling, they were suave, like you said, and
they were surfing on tidal waves, on computer generated tidal waves.
It's, you know, Timothy Dalton
outrunning lasers, space lasers,
invisible cars,
invisible cars.
Timothy Dalton is the grounded, stone faced, gritty killer that James Bond actually is.
And he, let's get into some License to Kill, and I'm sure we'll revisit this again more in depth as a movie. But as far as the killer goes, he was a homicidal maniac in License to Kill.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, he was just kind of unleashed. I mean, you saw a little bit of that in Living Daylights. I mean, he was obviously a different Bond than Moore. You know, so if you go from a few to a kill to Living Daylights, obviously you see the difference there. But he just kind of – they really kind of built up the dark, vengeful, violent Bond in the second one. So
yeah. Not to interrupt, but this is the – according to Wikipedia at least, this is the first – film not based on anything, any book.
Yes, that's correct. I did believe.
And so I sort of felt like when I was, you know, watching it, that it felt like it had something to prove, but it also felt like it had to go backwards a little bit to what the series was more about, which is, you know, the License to Kill has gruesome death scenes, it has poker, it has sharks, it has a bad guy with a pet on his shoulder, like, it's got the giant hideout and the nautical nonsense, like, it's got all this stuff that James Bond has always sort of been about.
And Wayne Newton.
And Wayne Newton. So, seriously, that's a grittier Wayne Newton than we're used to seeing.
I mean, I remember watching License to Kill and generally being discomforted a little bit by some of the gruesome death scenes. Like when
Benicio del Toro
is Benicio's ending fantastically. But then the the guy from the Young Riders, he played like Teaspoon from the Young Riders or whatever. He got tossed in the depressurized container and his face exploded.
Yeah. And that dude gets fed to the sharks.
And then he dumped the guy in the maggot drawer. Are we to believe that that guy died a slow and painful death by being consumed by maggots over the first one evening?
I believe it.
I can't handle that, man.
and not to mention that this is like, correct me if I'm wrong, Bond has gone rogue before, or at least he did after this film. But this is this to me feels like the best version of Bond going rogue.
He did it in the books. I'm trying to think of which one. Was in the movie version, he didn't. Whatever book came after On Her Majesty's Secret Service, he kind of went rogue for a while. I think they thought he was dead or something, and he was going after his wife's killer, basically.
That would be You Only Live Twice, according to...
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Well, Dan, we'll get you involved even more. So why don't you talk turkey about Dalton?
Well, I think Mike is right that I would go further and say that of Lazenby and Daniel Craig and Timothy Dalton, Dalton is the closest to the literary character, just because he's got that reluctance about him. You know, he comes off as a Bond who's sort of a little bit weary. Like, he'll do it, he'll kill somebody, and he'll kill him nasty.
Yeah.
He has to.
But that's he's right. Not,
but he's not, you know, it's not even like he feels guilt about it. It's just sort of like he's almost a little dead inside.
You know, even that's interesting, because when he delivers his occasional post-death or pre-death one-liner, it doesn't seem to be doing it with joy. In The Living Daylights, even though it had the action wasn't as huge in Living Daylights as License to Kill or the other Bond movies, but some of the stuff was incredibly memorable, like the cargo net flight on the back of the plane, which still blows my mind. And, you know, he tosses – the guy grabs his boot and he cuts his shoelace and the guy falls out. And the girl asks him, you know, what happened to Necros? He got the boot. You know, that's great. But he was – he didn't like – it's a great line, but he didn't utter it with the joy that you would
– Right. Right, and I think people miss that, and I think that's part of what, part of the reaction against him was. It's this catch-22 where the initial Sean Connery character was designed, on the one hand, capture who James Bond was in the novel, this kind of cold-blooded killer but semi-weary guy, and on the other hand, capture Ian Fleming's prose, which was all about clothing and great liquor and beautiful women and all this stuff, and to get all of that into a movie where there are no, there's no prose to it. there's no description. It's just you see what you get. And so, you know, I think that in those early movies, they did a good job of blending those two things. So you get kind of the essence of Fleming's books in the character of Bond. But I think it kind of set things up so it was hard for other people to take over. And with Roger Moore, you get a whole bunch of silliness and more of the suave part. And with Dalton, it's the swing in the other direction where you get much more the literary character, but you lose a lot of the style. But I still think it's cool. I mean, I think it's cool to just kind of have that version that's just the guy from the books who's a little bit tired of the gig, doesn't always like what he's being sent to do, will complain about it, but ultimately does the job and wails on people.
Now, the other interesting thing about Dalton was he seemed the least promiscuous of the Bonds, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, it was implied, like he made out with What's-Her-Face in the boat in License to Kill, mm-hmm. then jumped in the pool with her. And I mean, it wasn't like Lazenby, who couldn't keep it in his pants, and Roger Moore, who after a while, especially in A View to a Kill, you know, he's 60-something, you know.
Right, just becomes, starts getting scary.
It becomes borderline illegal, so.
Yeah, I think by that time, by the late 80s, you know, they were starting to have a problem in terms of the culture with that. And, you know, how is this going to play to audiences? And it's turning into a kind of a joke, and we don't really view women the way we did in the 60s and all that kind of stuff. And so I think that was, you know, a major I just don't think they'd figured out how to translate that aspect of the character into modern times. And I think they've done a better job in the Daniel Craig movies where he does fool around a lot, but there's also this sense that it's the job and he doesn't, you know, there's that interesting scene, not to go too far off kilter again, in Casino Royale where like none of the earlier Bonds would have done this, where he kind of bails on the chick to go and kill the guy.
Right. That's right.
Which shows that, you know,
right. His priorities.
Yeah, he's bed and women and everything, but it's the job.
And it's for a purpose. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's for a purpose. Whereas, I mean, even Connery, it was like anything that moved, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
He would just spray it around the Eastern Hemisphere. Well, okay, let's do a little bit of round robin here with Mr. Dalton. So some favorite Dalton moments. It could be Dalton murders. It could be Bond murders. It could be whatever. So, Mike.
I like when he gets fired and his little standoff with M.
That's true.
That's a good, you know, because see, the thing with Dalton was he's such a good actor that it's sort of like, to me, some of his better moments are just like when he's there, like seething and talking and acting, and not so much the action stuff, although there is some sweet action stuff. I mean, that whole sequence, like right after the opening credits where there's like the wedding and they're attacked on the bridge. Is that right after the credits, I think?
In
License to Kill?
Yep.
That's a pretty cool action piece.
It is. Is it a License to Kill where he's in the bar? He was like just interrogating some guys. I believe the bar fight breaks out. He defends himself against some dude with a swordfish, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. He's there with that girl with the crazy vest.
Harry Lowell. Is that her name?
Yeah. And Benicio del Toro is there with some other goons, and they get in a big fight that looks, extremely. It looks like a roadhouse scene.
Yeah. Man, Benicio is really creepy in that.
He is.
He's a creepy bastard.
He's strung out, and he, I mean, he may have met his end in the most painful way possible. I don't know, maybe the maggot guy probably, but I mean, it was just probably some schlub looking for some part-time work. You know, he didn't know that he was running drugs.
Yeah, and that weird, like, televangelists, like, shrine thing at the end of the film with its drug front. I mean, that's in itself is just bizarre.
So vintage 80s, like the cocaine. You know, all about the cocaine. Dan, favorite Dalton moment?
I got a couple of them, and both from License to Kill, both from kind of the beginning of License to Kill, too. I was like, you have that pre-credit, I think it's License to Kill. No, it's the first one's from Living Daylights. The pre-credits thing where they're climbing the mountain, the 300s,
right.
And the one, you know, gets, the guy cuts him off and he falls. And there's just that moment, it's pretty early on when we first see Dalton's face as Bond, but where he just goes down and looks at, you know, this dead 00 and sees that the line is cut. And there's just something about, I just remember even seeing that in the theater, and like his seriousness and his intensity, you could tell that like the Roger Moore days were done.
Yeah.
You know,
good point.
That's over with. You know, even just the furrow of his brow was like, all right, this is going to be some serious James Bond action going on. So that's one. Then the other one from the beginning of License to Kill, I just like the scenes at the wedding, mm-hmm. which are really odd in a, yeah. in a James Bond movie.
Right.
But the way that T-Dalt plays those scenes, you know, there's a kind of humor to him, and, you know, he's laughing a little bit, and there's a warmth and stuff that you don't normally see in Bond.
They were almost reminiscent of, going back to Honor the end of Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah,
when he gets married, you know, that first time, and it's sort of like, here's Bond letting loose, you know, in the beginning of License to Kill, it's his friend, I believe.
It's Felix, right? It's Felix Leiter.
Yeah, it's Felix Leiter. Felix.
Yeah, I think that's a good call, because I think that they sort of make the death of Felix's wife
yep.
all the more shocking, you know, and it gives Bond that much more intensity once he discovers their bodies and everything.
The whole sequence, and again, in License to Kill, you know, when he sneaks on board Martin Crest's drug running ship or whatever. So from the point where he sees his buddy, you know, the bad guys have him strung up, they killed him, you know, and they said, hey, his name was Sharky. And then just the whole sequence where he just steps out in broad daylight with a harpoon gun in his hand, you know, compliments a Sharky, bam, blasts with a harpoon, jumps out of the water. I mean, just totally improvising it, apparently. Jumps out of the water, grabs the guy's scuba gear. Then he hitches a ride on the plane, the drug plane, as it escapes, climbs aboard the plane in a pretty awesome practical stunt sequence, like drops one guy to his death out of the plane, punches another guy in the face with a cube of money, and then just ends perfectly as the plane, you know, everyone's looking on, the plane flies by, you see another guy just go flying out, you know, just screaming as he flies out. And then he just, there's like money, he's just got money on, he's just laughing like he's Demi Moore, an Indecent Proposal. So, just a great sustained T-Dalt action sequence. Just, you know, totally making up as he go along and so many corpses left in his wake.
And he, you know, I gotta say that he did a lot of those stunts himself and stuff. I mean, you know, not the really, really big ones, jumping out of planes and stuff, but hanging out on top of trucks and that kind of thing, you know, it wasn't a lot of blue screen stuff in his movies. He really did a lot of that. And, you know, because Roger Moore, there was that sense that he was untouchable.
Even though when he fought.
Really, he was totally unflappable. And, you know, for Dalton was like a throwback to Connery in the sense that, you know, here's a Bond who could be hurt.
Yeah.
He could be roughed up a lot. And, you know, he took some damage.
Yeah, whenever Roger Moore threw a punch or threw a kick, it was just like, that's got the force of a mosquito bite, you know, but apparently, right. It's in the script that the bad guy has to react painfully to that punch. Whereas T-Dalt, he felt like he was really doing damage. So, and as goofy again as the Papa Wheelie semi was, I'm a sucker for giant truck chase scenes. I love it.
Yeah.
Giant truck chase scenes, and that was a great one. And again, John Glenn directed that, but him and the writers, whatever, they really squeezed out as many gags as you possibly could when you're talking about a gas tanker chase scene, you know? They got everything. I mean, they had rockets being thrown into gas tanks, and so
yeah.
They squeezed every bit of possible gimmick out of that. And then ending with a superb final bad guy death, where Sanchez just gets torched. You know.
Oh yeah, poor Robert Davi.
That's just a good solid 80s. Yeah,
it is. Oh yeah,
80s plot line, cocaine, drug dealer,
cocaine,
you know, yeah,
drug lord.
like, right. Crockett and Tubbs could show up at any moment in that movie.
The only thing lacking to make it like the perfect 80s movie full of villains would have to been like NASA is involved somehow, you know?
Right.
He and Daryl and Flight of the Navigator, NASA's the perennial bad guy, like they're involved somehow. That would be the only thing that made it perfect. Well, I think, gentlemen, that brings us to the end of this edition of Objection.
I do want to add just one more thing before we go, which is if by chance Queen Elizabeth II is listening to this podcast, and I've heard that she does.
Okay.
I don't know if it's true. I'm just wondering why it is that we're not talking about Sir Timothy Dalton.
That needs to happen.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah, immediately.
She posts on her forums, so
that's
maybe
right.
She'll respond.
That needs to, I know she's a Facebook fan, so you know, Beth, make that happen for sure. Well, that is it. So go watch License to Kill and revisit its awesomeness. And watch Living Daylights, too. There's some good fun to be had there. And weep Absolutely. For the Maggot Man. Weep. So thanks again to Dan. And thanks, big thanks to Mike for kicking with us. And Dan, is there anything else we need to say?
Thanks. 10 points easy.
You have a nasty habit of surviving.